Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon, this is John Wilkes welcoming y'all back to The Whole Shebang, the show that aims to delve deeper into all sorts of aspects of livestock production, broadcasting from Roberta's Pizza here in deepest genteel old Bushwick town, Brooklyn. And so on today's show, we're looking at some youngish, have-a-go entrepreneurs who've started up new businesses in the US sheep and, I should add, goat world. Now, the sheep industry in America is in a desperate need of fresh young blood. Sheep meat consumption has dramatically fallen over recent years, and wool isn't what it was. So the average age of your sheepy keeper has gone past 60 years. I mean, who'd really want a life running around after a bunch of sheep when you're cold, wet, and you're having to bare-knuckle fight mountain lion, wolves, bears, and coyotes, the animal welfare and environmental organizations, plus you chuck in the financial uncertainty and often a distinct lack of Wi-Fi, and it could be grim. But it's not all bad news. It's looking very cool to some folk. So thankfully, there are those who want a piece of the herding action. Fear not, dear listener. The American Sheep Industry Association is acutely aware of this and is trying to encourage the young'uns into the field, as it were, with some recent initiatives designed to help. Their Let's Grow Funding and Young Entrepreneurs Committee all look to assist. But still, how do you make all this an attractive proposition for the next generation? Rest assured, there's hope. My three guests today all have independently created successful, thriving businesses around the humble sheep and goat. Two very much outside the box and one very much in it. My two outside box thinkers, Robert Irwin and Brittany Cole Bush, join me from California now. And in the second half of the program, Emily Shamlin is going to be talking to us. She's one of the US's top female sheep shearers, and she's currently in a wool shed in South Dakota, covered in sweat and wool. Robert Irwin, moving on to Robert. Robert's our first guest from California. Robert's based out in Lake County, California, deep in wine country, and from an early age knew that sheep were destined to be big in his life. He's a third generation sheepist, and his innovative business provides a sustainable, sought-after service for the vineyards in the area. The soon-to-be-approaching, I have it on very good authority, 5,000-head care sheep outfit works the vineyards and orchards. His sheep both deleaf the vines pre-harvest, clear up the unwanted grass weeds, and nowadays specialist cover crops planted between the vines, turning it into the best organic fertilizer known to man, good old-fashioned sheep manure. With help from his wife Jamie, the KO Sheep outfit is blazing a trail around the Clear Lake area for its biodynamic and sustainably inclined wine producers. Clients include Bonterra Organic and Fetzer Wines, and many more eager to sign up to the benefits of the Golden Hoof. I quote the man, "We're doing the same thing nature was doing before we showed up to control craziness. That's what our take on chaos is." Robert, good afternoon. How are you?
Very good. How are you doing?
Well, after all that preamble, we're good. I've tried to sum you up. I'll just move on quickly to Brittany, and I'd like to bring Brittany and introduce Brittany. Brittany Blazing a Trail is what second guest urban shepherdess Brittany Cole Bush is helping to prevent. She's an integral component of Star Creek Land Stewards, who since 2013 have been increasingly in demand using sheep and goats in the Bay Area near San Francisco, where fires are obviously a big issue at the moment, to clear up potentially combustible undergrowth from terrain often inaccessible to conventional methods, whilst at the same time both improving soil fertility and the vegetation. Her goats will also readily tuck into the really nasty toxic stuff, invasive weeds, that would leave other forms of livestock with their little tootsies in the air well dead. This season, Brittany has had 9 separate herds of mixed sheep and goats totaling 2,400 head under a watchful BDI, public agencies, energy companies and homeowners associations are increasingly employing her sustainable methods. The fire service love us, so Brittany tells us. And what's not to love about urban shepherdess Brittany Coldbush and her sheep and goats? Brittany, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, John.
How are you?
I am fantastic this morning on the West Coast.
Oh, my goodness me. Sun shining and too much sun shining, perhaps.
that's right.
That's right. Rob, can I just cut to you quickly? Sheep are part of your DNA, my friend. How did you get into sheep originally?
Well, my grandfather, both my grandfathers raised sheep. My grandfather, my mom's dad, was the first president of the Sheep Practitioners Veterinary Association. And then my mom and my uncle and my aunt all had 4-H projects that my mom and my uncle ended up turning into commercial, and that's how I was raised, within the raising sheep. And then my dad, kind of the same story on my dad's side, but without the veterinary stuff. And I out of 5 kids, I'm the only one that really, really enjoyed sheep, so I just kind of stuck with it.
Okay, and I believe that I've seen a story where we've talked about the how you funded your education through, at an early age, your parents gave you sheep, gave you kids sheep to actually help get you through college and stuff like that.
Yeah, the deal was they gave each one of us, I think, 5 sheep when we were born, and then they kind of took care of them for us until we got a little bit older, and then we got to decide what we wanted to do. We didn't have to pay any of the bills, but when we sold the lambs, it went into a savings account, and that's kind of how I got started with sheep, I guess. And then I kept buying out my brother's sheep, and then all 3 of my, or 2 of my sister's sheep out. And usually by the time we graduated high school, each one of us had about 15, except for I had closer to 100.
Entrepreneur from the start.
Yeah.
Brittany, now, you are not from a traditional farming background, it's fair to say.
That is very, very fair to say. I actually grew up at the North County, San Diego, right there on the beach, and don't come from an agricultural background one bit. I was very lucky to have a Basque American family from the Central Valley take me under their wing, and from a non-traditional background, became deep in the world of sheep and goats.
Right, and now you're very much up to your armpits in sheep and goats. I know. Could you tell us a little bit about Star Creek Land Stewards and what you get up to?
Sure. Star Creek Land Stewards is a contract grazing and land stewardship outfit that was actually developed based on some really amazing progress of restoration work on a ranch called Star Creek Ranch in the Santa Cruz Mountains that had been using sheep and goats for restorative efforts to reduce coyote brush and other invasives, trying to encourage some grasslands on this beautiful ranch. After seeing success with the number of sheep and goats over a course of 10 years, we had the idea of taking the sheep and goats off the ranch and pursuing some public contracts in contract grazing. And actually in 2012, we got our first big contract with a public agency called the East Bay Regional Parks District, and that started our business. And ever since then, we've been using sheep and goats in very carefully managed grazing projects all around the Bay Area, from San Jose all the way upwards to Sacramento.
Wow, that's cool. So your business is literally growing like wildfire, but you don't want a wildfire, obviously.
Exactly.
Robert, now then, Chaos Sheep Outfit, I think that is the most apt name for any business dealing with sheep. But there's more to it than that. Yeah, you and your wife, Jamie, set up Chaos Sheep. How did that come about?
Well, she was in college getting her, my wife's got a master's degree in science education, and she was involved, she'd gotten into her master's program, and came home one day, and I was trying to run sheep, and everything was just going wild, and she said, "This is just controlled chaos, isn't it?" I smiled at her, and I said, "Yeah." And so that winter, we for Christmas, we made Kahlua for every of our friends and family for Christmas gifts, homemade Kahlua, and we named it Chaos Kahlua, and we made a little wine. We used old wine bottles, so we made kind of a wine label that said Chaos Kahlua, and then when we started our sheep company, we figured that that's what it was. It had to be chaos.
But and I think it's fair to say your dedication to the cause in the early years, I hope you don't mind me sharing, but it was very tough for you and Jamie when you started, and the story goes that you actually lived in your truck when you started your business.
That is true. That is very true.
That shows determination, my friend. That really does.
Yeah.
Biodynamics is the watchword for what you're doing in the vineyards and the business and the people you're working with. Roughly, what role do the sheep play from your side of it in the biodynamics?
In the vineyard, what we're trying, like I joke around about it, but my competition's tractor.
Right.
I'm competing with tractors and herbicides and manual labor. Our main goal from post-harvest is we'll send the sheep out and they'll eat the leftover fruit, anything that didn't get picked or the harvesters, anything that dropped on the ground. And what that does is it cleans up the hosts that carry diseases over from one season to the next on the raisins. And then once that's done and we get rain and the grass grows, we do vegetation management. But what we do is we keep the grass between the rows and underneath the vine eaten down so that when spring comes and the buds come up, the airflow goes through the vines, which helps for frost protection, and it also helps for bug population. There's an array of reasons there, and the closer the grass is to the ground, the more sunlight that hits the ground, which will warm up the soil and radiate heat at the night, which also helps with frost protection. So there's a lot of reasons why the vineyard mows. But our goal is to remove the tractor and add the sheep.
That's the way to go. I can see, and I know I've seen videos of your customers incredibly satisfied with how all that's going. And moving on to you, Brittany, you're very much a blitzkrieg in a way. What you set out to achieve with your sort of blend of sheep and goats. Could you explain a bit about how you decide when you're given a project? You mix the sheep and the goats up, and why that is when you're offered a piece of land to work on.
Sure. Conversely, to Robert using sheep specifically for the vineyard work, we use a combo of both grazers and browsers. So the grazers are our sheep and the browsers are our goats, and we do that in a prescriptive manner, because often when we are contracted to graze, we're trying to reduce vegetation for this fire hazard. Sheep prefer a lot of the grasses, the annual grasses, sometimes the perennial grasses in there too. But the goats, they like a salad bowl array of different type of vegetation. So they'll often clear an understory. They get up to 6 feet under a patch of tree growth. They'll get into blackberry, poison oak. They love thistles. We decide to use sheep and goats based on identifying what's on that landscape, the vegetation on that landscape, and then we decide the ratio of sheep to goats depending on what we're reading on the land and our goals and context on that piece of land.
So there's a bit of science to this, obviously.
Yes. We definitely arrange our projects in a prescriptive manner. Of course, identifying the goals and understanding the terrain, understanding the vegetation type, and depending on those things, that's when we decide, hey, this is an all-sheep job, or this is an all-goat job, or in most cases, it's a mixed-species job with both the sheep and the goat.
Yeah, so you're utilizing both species. And Robert, with the biodynamic thing, you're partnering with Bonterra, who obviously a very notable vineyard, and Fetsa Wines as well. Did they come to you, or did you go to them? How did that all kick off?
Actually, we were the first year of the drought, and we were running short on feed. And most of our sheep are located at now, or during the vineyard season, is in Mendocino County. And I drove over the Hopland Grade, and I stopped in McDowell Family Vineyards, which has been sold and owned by another family now. But I stopped in and talked to the man there, and I said, "Hey, I won't charge you a dollar. I need somewhere to go with sheep, and I need it tomorrow. What's the opportunity there?" And he was willing to take a chance on us, and we unloaded the sheep, and the rest is history. Raphael and Dave drove by and saw the sheep out mowing away like crazy, and they drove in and asked us, you know, we'd be really interested in it, and so we just walked the sheep from McDowell's over to Fetzer Bonterra, and away we went.
And the data, so you have been, you and your wife, Jamie, have been collecting data to try and put some science behind this, I gather, that you, and that data will be available shortly, that of the proving the benefits to the growers of what you are, you know, what you're providing with what they call the golden hoof, the sheep on their properties. Is that something which is coming up shortly?
Yeah, we just had a Jamie just had a meeting with the extension agents in Mendocino County. I think day before yesterday. But we've got three things waiting to come back. But the things that have come back so far are the soil compaction is actually lower or equal or lower than using tractors. So that was one of our huge hurdles. Everybody was nervous about the soil compaction with the sheep. So far, and we're going to do the study for a three-year period, but so far there's either it's equal or less than soil compaction. And the one theory that I've had in my mind was not the amount of nitrogen in the soil, but the available nitrogen in the soil during the peak growing season, right at bud break when the plant comes alive and starts soaking up the nutrients. On the theory that if you mow the cover crop and you till it in, it requires nitrogen to break down the nitrogen right when the plant's growing. And so my theory is, and we're still waiting on the results for this, but there'd be the same amount of nitrogen in the soil, but there'd be 30% to 40% more available nitrogen to the plant at the time when the nutrient requirements are the highest for the vine.
That's really, you know, that's going to be a huge plus for the growers. And Brittany, in your line of work, you're going in, you're blitzing these areas, you're taking all this possibly combustible stuff out, and I gather there's some element of the vegetation improves after you've been through. I mean, these areas, I suspect, maybe have not been touched for years or even ever. And what does it look like after the sort of the goats and sheep have been through? Does it regrow the same, or do you get interesting other sort of vegetation coming back?
Well, in many of these areas, there hasn't been any animal disturbance for a number of years. What we find is after an application of grazing successionally over a number of years, we're actually breaking oxidized thatch. And as Robert had previously mentioned, the animal impact with those hooves opens up the space for sunlight to get into that soil and also break down that thatch and start a nutrient cycle that for many years without that disturbance has been void in that land. So what happens after we graze, after a couple of seasons, you can see a transition from perhaps a stand of just a monoculture of hemlock or thistle. You'll start seeing diversity of things that haven't been there for perhaps decades. Really, we're trying to invigorate a very diverse and a healthy and thriving, in some cases, grassland, and we're able to do so with multiple applications. So we definitely see improvement on landscape when we are managing the animals to graze at certain periods of time of the year. And fortunately, a lot of the agencies we work with really value the stewardship aspect of this work. So we're not just mowing, we're not just a mowing service, so to speak, but we're actually restoring integrity of a landscape, the soil, all of the nutrient systems, and really increasing the vitality and the vibrance of a landscape that perhaps was kind of in at rest or sleeping. So it's really wonderful to see from year to year improvement in succession of some of these areas that we graze.
So you're both, I mean, Robert, coming back to you, you're both basically practicing holistically, and I know, I think you're everybody's aware of Alan Savory and the Savory Institute and the work they're doing. And is that something you're cognizant of, that you're trying to adhere to holistic principles in what you're doing in the vineyards?
We do a rotational grazing system. We've applied all that stuff. We just enrolled in a ranching for profit, which is a kind of the business end of the holistic management stuff, and we're going to educate ourselves in that. We've gone to several different seminars for the holistic stuff, but it's just a continual learning of everything you can to help make things better. And like Brittany said, it's not just about, you know, holistic, the best word I like to about holistic, but the sheep can't succeed without the vineyard succeeding, without the soil succeeding, without everything's got to work in harmony all at the same time, including the people that are taking care of the vineyards and the sheep or the goats.
Move on now to jointly the idea of sustainability. It's a word that's chucked around the place, and to me, from what I can see from what you're doing, Robert, and I suspect Brittany, I mean, sustainability is about show me the money. It's about making this work financially, otherwise it doesn't stack up. And I know, you know, Robert, you talk in your new Vimeo video about the dinosaurs, and is that something that the commercial aspect is obviously incredibly important to the chaos sheep outfit?
Yeah, we got to change, we got to go forward, but we've got to, like, one of the things we've got to do, and Brittany is a, like, the perfect example of it, of what she can bring to the sheep and goat industry, and what it's a new look, it's a fresh idea, and the, you know, a monotony of people have been staring at the same problem of sheep and goat numbers declining in the United States over a 50-year period, and it's going to take those fresh ideas and the fresh faces and the different way of looking at the same problem and coming up with a better solution to get us to kind of go forward.
I mean, Brittany, the idea of getting youngsters, people like yourself, into the industry, how can it happen? What fundamental things could happen that would be able to make the industry open up to other youngsters like yourself who perhaps aren't from agricultural backgrounds? What do you think? I know you've got a bit of a master plan that you told me about.
Well, first and foremost, We have to make vocations that are viable. Our livelihoods have to be viable in this work. And so what I ultimately am trying to do is create a model and test a model to prove that it's viable, so it can be replicated, so more people, new, fresh, like Robert said, you know, fresh profiles can enter into this industry, come into the industry with pride being a land steward, being a mindful livestock operator, and kind of stack the functions of many things. We're producing food, we're producing fiber, and we're also contributing to not just a sustainable system, but a regenerative one. Because that's ultimately what we'd like to do, is we'd like to make the areas in which we're grazing and the people that we're working with, we want it to all work. And so for me, the grand plan is to create a model, test it, and then eventually teach it. I would love the opportunity for, a shepherding school of the West to come into play at some point when a contract grazing model, a stacked enterprise, is proven to be successful. And so that's where I'm at in the process of trying to garner the support to create a replicable model for others to get in this beautiful industry that's all about contributing to improvement of the land and also integrating, you know, urban folks into it by creating businesses where they can support us operators through purchasing both, you know, the fiber from our products as well as the food created as well.
The side of it. And Robert, I know, you know, we were talking the other day, you are desperate to expand your business. You've got a successful business model, proven, and yet, you know, finding funding for expansion can be tough. I'm certain. Can you talk about that a bit? About how, you know, avenues that are open to you to be able to expand your business?
So I get probably 10 to 15 phone calls a month from vineyards and orchards outside of the area that we are currently working in. They're interested. Would like to do the sheep process through their stuff. I was just driving through an area yesterday down south of Sacramento, and I went there. Everything that I'm using is right there. There's orchards. There's alfalfa fields. There's grain stubble. And there's vineyards all in the same area, and you could rotate. And as I was driving through there, I was kicking myself for not moving there instead of where I moved, because I wouldn't have had to have traveled anywhere. I would have been able to be more centralized. I should have toured a little bit more of the country before I picked a spot to live. But the opportunities are there. We get phone calls. I mean, consistent. The funding part's going to be very difficult. I had the fortune to be able to shear sheep, so we financed ourselves through my sheep shearing, and then we were able to move forward through. You know, we were able to make little steps, and instead of owning the sheep, and this is a great opportunity for young people that are new to getting in. Could either mentor under Brittany or me, and then you can manage sheep during times of the year for other people. Superior Farms is one of the many companies that will purchase the livestock, get you the livestock to run. They'll get you in line with a few producers to help you out. But you need the experience before they'll give you the sheep. But then you don't have to have this mass amount of money. The only, you know, how we got started is we don't own 5,000 sheep. We manage 4,000 sheep for other companies that don't have that grass for that time of the year.
I know, Robert, but I'll come back to you, Brittany. The idea that, you know, it's these skills. These herding skills are. They're not learned overnight, and I think shepherds are born rather than taught. It's just something in you where you have this sort of affinity with the livestock, and you're able to work with it. Which, you know, it can be taught, and there's people pick it up. But the idea that where are these skills going to come from? Is it going to be from mentoring Brittany, or how do you feel? You know, can there be more be done with the agricultural colleges and things like that?
Well, the art of shepherding is it's an absolutely beautiful thing, and you know, I've only worked with sheep now, sheep and goats for almost a decade now, and I just feel that I'm just an infant in this whole thing. My one of my dearest friends in the sheep business and mentors, he tells me, you didn't come from sheep, but you have sheep in your blood, and it's never going to go away. And so I almost feel that, you know, I was just one of those people who was born into the world with sheep in my blood. And if I have the honor and privilege to continue to learn the wisdom of the shepherd, tradition that hasn't been lost in some parts of the world, but if I can kind of continue to learn those skills and the beautiful art of shepherding, I would love to continue to see that grow and that tradition, you know, spread through to folks who come from non-traditional backgrounds.
And then, Rob, coming back to you on that one, I know, I mean, the situation is to get skilled labor, to get herders, and it's a big issue for the American sheep industry. Traditionally, they've come from abroad. They've come from the Basque region and now tend to come from Central America. These are seasonal workers who come to the U.S. And you are, I mean, we were talking about it, you're struggling to find competent, able livestock herders. Must be a problem.
Yes, we have not signed up for the H-2A program up until recently to get the H-2A guest workers. We have signed up recently because we can't find people that enjoy the work, you know, that like to work and enjoy being outside. You know, they like one or two things, but not everything, and the one thing about sheep, and Brittany kind of hit it, is you got to love sheep to raise sheep. Like, you actually have to love the animal if you're going to raise the animal. I think cattle or different animals, it's not quite like sheep. To really do a good job, it shows in the animals. I mean, it really does. The amount of work you put into them, the amount of time, the energy, your effort, how fast you move them through things. You don't keep them too long. You're really on the, you know, on it. It'll show through the diseases and parasite problems, but it'll also show in just the, you know, just by walking into the animals. You can tell how the sheep are managed just by, you know, just by walking through the animals. It's a touch, you know, but it's got to come from the heart. It's just, I don't know how else to explain it. It's a touch that some people have, and I don't agree with the majority of the industry would say you have to be born in it, and I think that you're born with it, whether you're born with it or not, well, you know, with the sheep or not. I think there's some people that have that touch, and there's some people that don't. And our goal is right now is trying to find those people that have it.
And let's hope you do. You hunt them out. It is. You know, I agree. I travel around a bit, and sheep people are funny. I can be wherever, and there's this innate sense of a brotherhood almost. And the way that maybe to other livestock, like as you said, the cattle world, that the sheep world, the people are a bit more laid back. And how you've got to be when you've got, you know, sheep running around you, and it's a different mindset possibly. I just wanted to talk quickly about the Basque thing and the influence of the Basque was huge. In the earlier years, and Brittany, I think you're hoping to go out to the Basque region, all being well, with a Fulbright scholarship. Is that the case?
That's the goal. That's the goal. You know, I think that it's really important to learn from tradition to help inform the future. And my goal is to get out there and integrate into the Basque landscape and meet folks both on the Spanish and French side, because I ultimately think that that's going to be essential in informing, you know, changes and evolution of how we raise both sheep and goats in the Western states. So that's the goal.
That's the goal. And Robert, you've got to, I mean, we were talking about this, the other day, the Basque thing for you slightly different. You know, you feel that's the Basque people, the influence they've had is slightly different or waning.
Yeah, compared to the current guest workers in the H-2A program, the Basque came over like, you know, kind of like me, but from a worse situation. It was post-World War II, their country was in, you know, great, you know, huge depression. They came over here with a shirt on their back, all started out herding sheep, but most of the guys took sheep in payment instead of money. And currently the West is run by Basque sheep herders that came over here with a T-shirt on their back, with nothing else. And not only did they change the sheep industry and kind of take over the sheep industry, they took over, I mean, you go throughout the Western United States from, you know, Montana west, and they own the trucking companies, the gas stations. So they, you know, and they all came over on the guest H-2A program, which is a model we need to get up and going again. The way I see it is that's how we're going to get our next generation up and going. We get them over here, either they're from here or away from here. We get them over here, and then we get them, you know, they take sheep instead of money, and you end up with a guy that's put everything together, and as they're learning, most of those guys already know how to herd sheep, the Basque people, but, you know, going forward, we're going to have to teach the herding part, but you're learning the economics and the herding is, you know, if you're earning the sheep as you're going, but you're going to have to figure out what the cost of to run those sheep is, so it's a educational process through a 3 or 4 year, 5 year deal. As a kid, my heroes were those guys that started out with nothing, and now they've got 10,000 ewes that they own. Everything's paid for, they've done a great job. They've got great sheep. There's only one way to have made it from 1940 till today, and that's to do a great job every year and always do a good job and be really thorough in what you're doing. So the people that are still in business today have gone through everything, the farm crisis to when the wool incentive went away, to when the lamb market tanked. They've lived through every bit of it, and the amount of information that they hold in their head is. You can't put a value on it. I'm really worried going forward that value that's there is going to be lost because there's not going to be a generation underneath them to learn from.
We've got to find a new country to bring people in from with verve and vigor to invigorate the industry. Very quickly, the end of this section. Brittany, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Wow, John, that's an exciting question.
In a few words.
I would love to see operating a viable business that is stacked, where I am helping to contribute to awesome restoration projects and fire hazard abatement in all around the Bay Area. I'm now living in West Marin, so my hope is to be working closer to home in West Marin,
right,
with a herd or two of my own sheep and goats.
Yep.
I would love to be continuing to recruit new young folks to learn about this business and really be testing a viable model to be replicated around. So my hope is to be running my own operation closer to home and getting more people interested and involved in this contract grazing and loving the land with sheep and goats.
Sounds a wonderful plan. Mr. Owen, what is your plan? I mean, I was looking at a bet you had about $1 million that you'd be not doing what you're doing. So I'm not a gambling man because I saw you clear at a roulette table in Reno, and it was pretty efficient. So do you see yourself with 10,000 ewes in 5 years' time? That's my question to you. Do you see yourself doubling Chaos Sheep in 5 years?
I don't know. I think the possibility is there. We've grown really fast in a short period of time. We started out with owning 50 ewes. So today we own just under 1,000. The next 5 years, my goal is to become really efficient at what we're doing. And I'm with Brittany. I want to start a school, get people in. I really think we can get Americans. I'm not as focused on overseas, but it's how to get to the people that want to do it.
Right.
That are serious about it, get them out, get them educated, get them going, and then get them started in another deal. I think that the growth, we've got to get the growth of the industry back and to get it to, our focus is to really get efficient at what we're at. We're probably going to be up to about 8,000 sheep in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
That would fill up our current contracts with grazing. That wouldn't be any additional contracts.
Right.
But the education, and because I think through the education part we'll get our workforce and we'll have it regenerative. Every 2 to 3 years we'll get new guys in and get them started and then get them out on their own, and
it'll mushroom and grow. I think two things. A, I'm not going to bet against you for 10 million in 10,000 sheep in 5 years, because I know you. And the other thing is, I think if, the bigger part is perhaps listening to this, American Sheep Industry Association, I think, you two guys are a shining example of what can be achieved with off your own initiative, off your own bat, and I applaud you both. It's been super having you on. Thank you both so very, very much, and look forward to catching up with you hopefully in the fall, maybe over, really much enjoy looking you up. And thank you. And we'll go to cut to a short break now, and then after the break we will be joined by Emily Shamblin, who is one of the premier female professional sheep shearers in the United States. Thank you very much, and thank you both.
Let me tell you, thank you, John.
Story that your blood will chill to hear. Story of the day when I first met my greatest fear. I was traveling down in flight 66 at 6 p.m. that day. While sitting in my window seat, I felt the flow get away. Well, 30,000 feet, sure a long way down to fall. You can bet on my way down, I was sure to count them all. Now and then I sort of did regret my choice to fly. Ryan lost my luggage and I was gonna die. It happened to me, it could happen to you. So take the bus or take the train. And remember the day when I fell through.
Hi, welcome back to the second half of The Whole Shebang. I'm John Wilkes, and I'm broadcasting to you from Roberta's Pizza here in deepest Brooklyn. Joining us now is Emily Shamblin, hopefully taking a well-earned break from the back-breaking work she's been doing all day, shearing sheep. Emily, hi. Emily, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Sorry, I can hear you. Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. There you go. You're good. I didn't think I'd got you, but I got you. I'm just going to explain a bit what you do. You shear sheep, and you're very good at it. You're one of only a handful of full-time female shearers in the U.S. You're raised on an East Coast dairy farm, and it proved tricky to find someone to shear your own little flock. So you took it upon yourself to do it. And then at a very tender age, you determined to improve your skills and style and technique and enrolled at the Maryland Shearing School. And the instructor's initial reticence in allowing, quote, I think I quote you right, this skinny little kid, onto the course was misplaced and soon dispelled, as you are now 15 years later, clipping sheep with the best of them and often competing in competitions against fellow male shearers. Your season starts in Maryland, I think in sort of Maryland, Virginia, in April, May. And then you head out way out west with your husband to the bigger range outfits where you join us today. Now, shearing, it's blooming tough, hard work physically and mentally. And with some animals, I kid you not, weighing nearly 400 pounds. That's like a small pony covered in wool. It isn't for the faint-hearted or for the unfit. And you are proving a great ambassador for this highly necessary, highly skilled and blinking tough profession. Emily, good afternoon.
Thanks for that.
Well, no, it's the truth. So, okay, basically, why, silly question, why do we need to shear sheep?
Well, the short answer is that we've basically bred out their natural ability to shed their wool or hair like a normal animal, like a dog or cat will shed. Sheep, we have bred them to not do that, so we have... we've physically prevented them from being able to regulate their body temperature through shedding.
And so, obviously, and there's other aspects affect, with leaving wool on sheep, you know, because of the nature of wool, and it retains sort of bodily emissions and stuff like that, you can get dreadful problems with fly laying eggs on sheep. And perhaps you could talk a bit about that, which it's past lunchtime, so we're good. You can talk a bit about what happens.
Yeah, I mean, there are other side effects of leaving the wool on. You know, because they're not able to wipe after going to the bathroom, they can get very dirty on their back ends, which can cause a lot of problems. You know, flies will smell that and will want to lay their eggs there, and then the eggs will hatch and will feed on the animal, which causes, you know, oozing and sores, and they will actually tunnel into the skin. It's pretty nasty when you run across a bad case of what we call fly strike.
Fly strikes, right. It isn't fun.
The wool will start to felt and basically become like a carpet, like a solid piece of wool, which you can't even pull apart. On their body, which prevents them from respirating, it prevents them from sweating. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, secondary complications to not taking it off in a timely manner.
So it is very much a welfare issue that this needs to take place for the sheep's well-being.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So I talked a bit about how you got into shearing. How on earth did you? I mean, did you just pick up a handpiece? That's the piece of equipment you use that does the cutting bit. Did you just pick one up and have a go? How did it start?
Well, I think I had the traditional everybody attempts to shear a sheep sort of moment. You know, you have a pair of rusty hand shears in like a back shed, and it's like, okay, this needs to come off, and you're going to try to do it with these rusty hand shears, and it's a disaster. You get like, you know, a couple inches off, and you're like, your hand's about ready to fall off. It's bleeding from blisters already, and you're like, this is just not going to work.
Right.
You know, and I was young. I was still in 4-H, so you call all your 4-H friends. You're like, hey, can somebody come over and do this? And, of course, nobody wants to do it. You know, you call some of the professionals in the area, and they don't want to come out. And it's an extremely frustrating thing, especially if you're not really well into the community.
Right.
I mean, once you get to know other sheep people, it's fairly easy to find good references and, you know, get connected with, you know, knowledgeable people. But, you know, just a kid with a couple 4-H lambs, you're like, I don't know what to do. I don't know where to turn. So I did the blade shearing thing.
The blade? Oh, my. Yeah, we've all been there. Dagging shears. What a wonderful invention. I don't know who invented those.
Exactly. But
they obviously got a sick mind. When did you go motorized? And so you bought it? Because obviously, if you could perhaps explain, shearing is done. It's a mechanical piece of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
yeah. So go on, please.
Yeah. You know, the cheapest way to shear sheep is obviously with a pair of hand shears, but it's also the toughest physically. So most people use the clippers or machine shears. We already own them because, like you had said in the introduction, I grew up on a dairy farm. We showed dairy cattle and dairy goats through 4-H. So we already had a pair of clippers that I was familiar with using for that purpose. And it was just a matter of upgrading to, you know, a shearing head, which is a little more intimidating because the teeth, the actual cutting edge, are a little bit further apart. But, you know, if you're familiar with following the body contours of the animal, and that's one of the, you know, when you come to people who learn how to shear quickly, I mean, it's just having that finesse and knowing how to follow the body of the animal and, you know, being able to feel the animal through the head of the clippers. You know, that's a big part of it.
It's all about touch, I know. But so therefore, you had a go, you liked it, and you thought you could do it. So then you undertook training, and I believe it's right that there is a recognized, in fact, shearing a sheep is like a dance. It's choreographed, and every movement is virtually written in a book, how you should do it, textbook style, with what I think it's the Bowen method. Is that something that so you then decided to get some technical skills?
Yes, and so I went to the Maryland Shearing School, and they teach the Bowen method, which is a New Zealand style method that was actually introduced not that many years back. And if you follow this method, it really is the best way of getting the wool off. The wool comes off in one piece in the shortest amount of time, so there's less stress on the animal, and it just minimizes how long you have to hold the animal down while you're doing this. And it very much is a dance. They really encourage you to just follow that pattern precisely. You know, everybody, when they're learning, tries to figure out how to do it better on their own, and they always end up going back to the Bowen method every time because it really is the fastest, safest way to get the wool off in a timely manner.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's a job that gets done millions of times a year by lots of people, and the fact that this guy basically laid down the most efficient way to do it, and it's never been bettered, and I think it's what's accepted as being the standard mm-hmm. way to do it. Now, obviously, it's an incredibly physically tough and mentally tough occupation to be into. How on earth do you keep your fitness levels up to be able to do this day in, day out?
Well, that's why I travel. You know, you can just try to pick it up in the spring every year and just do a few, but I mean, you go online, and I'm in a couple shearing groups online, and you hear every year, you know, people are in agony at the beginning of the season because they're not in shape. And I mean, it really isn't something. I mean, you can go to the gym and you can lift weights and you can try to stay fit, but the actual muscles used in shearing are not muscles that you can really specifically work on in a gym setting. So unless you're doing it year-round, which is what I am attempting to do,
right,
you're going to be in a lot of pain.
Because the actual stance, if perhaps our listeners might not have seen, but if you see somebody shearing, the actual stance of your back is probably about the chiropractors would be going, have kittens when they see it, because you basically are at 90 degrees, aren't you? You know, you don't bend, your knees are merely there to hold the sheep, and you are bending from the back, and it's... you know, it's something which I'm full of admiration that you can do it day in, day out. And you're talking about the size of sheep in this country are getting so big. I saw you at the Maryland event, you know, share what I thought were big, and you said, no, that's not big. So, I mean, these animals are huge.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a big complaint sort of in the industry as a whole, or at least for shearers. You know, the sheep just keep getting bigger, and the shearers aren't getting bigger. So,
right.
You know, it just is more risky when you're trying to hold down an animal that weighs two or three times what you do.
Yeah.
You know, and it really takes a skilled person to handle animals like that, you know, and that's become a problem in trying to attract new people to this profession, you know. A beginner is not going to be able to handle an animal that's 350 pounds. So, you know, that much frustration right up front really discourages people from even attempting to learn the skill.
That's a big shame, really. It's, I mean, obviously, you are, with respect, I mean, you're competing in a particularly male environment. You know, how do you get on in that? Is it something do you relish the challenge when you're going head to head with somebody? Because I know shearers always are looking how many the person next to them's done in the day. How does that work for you when you're in shearing sheds in a commercial situation? Is it all cool?
Well, yeah. I mean, the guys have been really encouraging. I was lucky that I grew up and I learned how to shear in an area of the country which is very much dominated by more female presence in the farming community. So there was a lot of encouragement from the farmers and from, you know, other people that were shearing in the area as females. So there was a lot of encouragement there. When I started competing at the American level, going out west to competitions, you know, there is a lot of frustration as you watch these guys. I mean, they're able to just pick up these big sheep no problem. So you really have to learn how to finesse around some of these bigger sheep. And there's a lot of frustration there, but, you know, because it's such a small community, there is a lot of encouragement. And, you know, we all ultimately work together. But, yeah, I mean, there is a lot of competition on the boards. And I wouldn't say that I'm not a competitive person. So I'm always trying to keep up with them as much as possible. But
I can well imagine. I can well imagine. So, what could be done to encourage more youngsters into the... Because are there enough shearers in America to shear American sheep, or do you get Australians and Kiwis coming up for the season here? Because in the UK, I know we get a lot of people coming from down south coming up to shear. Is it the same here?
Well, I mean, the American Sheep Shearers Council, I mean, is really encouraging local people to learn. But you're absolutely correct. There is an enormous shearer shortage worldwide at this point. You know, people just aren't picking it up like they used to. The sheep are getting more difficult. The wages are kind of going down. The conditions are sort of going down. So, I mean, there's a lot of things working against new people getting into the business. So we are bringing in a lot of, like, you know, Ecuadorians to shear through that H2A program. There's a lot of people bringing in shears. But, you know, the root of it is we want shears in their own communities. You know, it's so much more, I don't know, for a farmer to have somebody local do their sheep, I think there's a lot more to that. So, you know, it is my hope that we can keep training, you know, young guys to keep doing it in their communities and keep it local as opposed to needing to go overseas.
Do you see the American sheep industry, you know, the governing body, do they need to get involved more with this to promote it, or how do you see it being put out there?
Well, you know, I did a season in New Zealand a couple of years back, and the atmosphere over there is a lot more encouraging. You know, the competitions are an enormous deal for each town, whatnot. Everybody hosts a shearing competition. So there is a lot of prestige and a lot of, you know, people, they're like celebrities over there. So a lot of the younger guys are still keen to get involved, even though it's very difficult and, you know, there's a steep learning curve.
Right.
There's something at the end to sort of aspire to. Over here, it's looked upon as sort of, you know, lesser work. You know, there's really not much to aspire to. Yes, we have a couple competitions, but even then, you know, the prize money barely covers your travel costs. So how does that encourage, you know, your younger, more competitive, talented guys getting into it?
This needs to change. We need somebody to step in. We need a big sponsor. We need a big competition, and we need to get some coverage around this, because I think it would help. I think it would really draw attention to it.
Absolutely.
Now, moving on to a ticklish question. Now, there has been in the last 12 months, by a fairly well-known welfare, inverted commas, I'll use the word loosely, organization, PETA, and they loosed go a video which isn't good viewing, I will accept. It was, I believe, done in an Australian wool shed of some treatment of sheep, which I would not condone, and I find thoroughly abhorrent. But they used this, played this, and it went viral. And then they followed up with a weird picture of some guy from a totally obscure Australian vegan metalcore band who needed a concert to promote here in the US. So they get him standing holding a fiberglass model of a lamb that's been ripped up and torn to pieces or so, but it looks, for their wool-free year thing. And at the time, it caused there was a bit of a major ramifications. Australia, given it's worth, you know, $2 billion or whatever, and it did cause a few raised eyebrows. But in all my time with sheep and the time I've, you know, been involved, I never saw anything like this. There's bad things happen in any industry, I understand that, but as far as I'm aware, I've never seen anything like this. I mean, you're on the front line. What do you see?
Well, you know, right after that, the musician holding the mutilated, you know, lamb corpse in his hand.
After that, plastic fiberglass went out on Facebook, there
was very much a pushback with the shearers groups. You know, a lot of the shearers posted holding a picture of a sheep that they had just sheared.
Yeah.
Pristine. I mean, and, you know, there's so much negative publicity around shearing. You know, people like to harp on the fact that we're paid per animal. So we only get paid by the number of animals we do. You know, and they're like, oh, that encourages this messy brutality. And I really am offended by those sort of implications because, you know, the farmers are there. The farmers are standing there. You know, you talk to two lovely farmers at the beginning of this program who obviously have affection and caring for their animals. And nobody is going to stand by and watch somebody, you know, completely rip apart their flock. That just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. And it's not to say that the animals are not frustrating to handle.
No.
But, you know, these sorts of extreme circumstances that they keep, you know, they want to put up on a pedestal and say that this is the norm are just outrageous.
I agree entirely. I think the idea of, you know, propagating negativity I mean, the guy, mm-hmm. the guy, whatever he's called, Jonah Weinfonen or whatever, from this group that is now chugging their way across on a concert tour. Oddly, it came onto the scene just before the concert tour, but we won't even go there. And the guy had never been in an Australian sheep shed, didn't, you know, had never seen it. So I don't think these people who are bleating and moaning about it until they actually get and see some are in a position to make any mm-hmm. comment. I don't know. How do you feel?
Well, and, you know, my favorite thing to say to people, you know, because whenever I do a public demonstration or I'm doing a talk or whatnot, I like to compare it to, imagine trying to shave your legs while running. I mean, that's inherently dangerous. You're shearing an animal with incredibly sharp utensils, and there has to be a certain level of skill, and obviously the animal is not 100% on board with what is going down.
Indeed.
So is there an amount of risk? Absolutely. But every shearer out there is just heartbroken when things fall apart, when something happens. Even tiny cuts are just so frustrating, especially to me as a shearer, because inevitably that's all people talk about, and it's like, You're trying. I think, and that's the draw to learning how to shear, is that you're always striving to shear that perfect sheep. You know, the pristine, smooth, everything off, and just be beautiful. You want those sheep to run out there and just be gorgeous.
Yeah. It's like the perfect
way. And to constantly
wave.
Harp on the negative, you know, the minor scratches and things.
Yeah.
They are absolutely frustrating. I'll tell you, the shearers are the first people to hate looking at them. You know, so you're telling us something we already know.
Yeah.
And we're constantly striving to fix.
There's a huge amount of pride within the industry. And I would just like to relate a tale. I watched you shear for the first time at the Maryland Sheep and Wool event. And you were there in front of, I counted them, sort of in fours, sheep counting style. It was 400 people sitting on a grassy bank on rugs, from little toddlers up to grown-ups. Watched you pull, you got a sheep out of a pen and you put it on a blanket and you shore it. And when you finished, the lady started clapping and another lady started clapping. And if you remember, before, in the space of a few seconds, everybody was roaring with applause and they were standing up. And to me, that was the perfect antidote. And what was the most wonderful thing, the little kiddies came running down to you and you gave them a piece of wool off that sheep that you'd just shorn. And you thought they'd got an iPhone 6. I mean, it was a wonderful antidote to some of this other stuff we've been talking about, and you know, I think there needs to be more of that. I mean, wool big picture in the United States, the industry is, how would you say it's balanced against the, you know, the southern countries, Australia? I mean, is our wool used readily?
Yes, our wool tends to be a lot coarser and a lot less uniform in consistency. You know, Australia and New Zealand do such a superb job of having larger groups of uniform breeds so that they, you know, their products are more desirable. You know, there's so much lamb wool here in the United States, and, you know, tennis balls have to be made out of something. and there's more, you know, carpet-type wool, which is, you know, lower quality, less desirable. You know, a lot more blackface-type sheep, which is lower quality wool. But that wool still gets used. It still has a market. It still is necessary for some product or another.
And so you would say you're very happy where you are with your business. And, I mean, I asked Robert and I asked Brittany, you know, how do you see, I mean, are you still going to be shearing sheep in 5 years' time? Is that something you know, you're going to keep at it? How's the body sticking up?
Oh, you know, I feel pretty good. You know, it's interesting to sort of follow the progression. You know, when you're younger and you have all this energy and you're like, oh, I'm going to do this. You know, you might not have the skill set where it needs to be.
Right.
But the enthusiasm is there. And now it's like, okay, I feel like I have, you know, better skills. You know, the energy might be waning, but you just sort of get into a pattern and it's just comfortable.
Yeah.
And as long as, you know, you keep yourself safe, I feel like I harp on that more now, is, you know, just putting myself in situations where I'm not going to get hurt, you know, where the sheep are controlled. And,
right.
You know, you can just get in this beautiful rhythm of just shearing sheep, and it really doesn't have to be this.
Do you go into a zone?
To get, you know, faster and better all the time, because I really feel comfortable with the way I shear.
Sorry, I interjected that. Do you go into a zone when you're doing this? Do you kind of just go to a different place in your head when you're tired and you've still got like 20 or 30 sheep in the pen and you really want to be somewhere else? How do you mentally? Because I do understand do you just kind of go to a better place, to a beach somewhere, or how do you get through those last 20 when you've had enough?
Yeah, I mean, if you can just sort of turn off your brain, that's when you just sort of go into autopilot and it just flows. Yeah. I find out here in, you know, South Dakota when we're shearing big flocks, I'll listen to a book while I'm shearing. So you're not even really thinking about, you know, the next pen of sheep or whatnot. You're just sort of listening to your story and you're just going about your day. And at the end of the day, you've listened to a book and you got a couple sheep sheared. So, I mean, it works so pretty good.
education and income all in one swipe.
Absolutely.
Well, it's. I'll let you now. Obviously, you want to get rushing back to some more 400-pound sheep, but it's been a pleasure talking to you. And as I said in my preamble, you are a wonderful ambassador to what is a highly necessary and very welfare-friendly job that's performed here in the United States. And I salute you for what you do. And thank you for joining us, Emily. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to seeing you sometime soon when you're knocking some wool off some sheep. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I've been John Wilkes, and I've enjoyed today's show immensely, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to entrepreneurs. These are people who are having a go, and they are thriving in the sheep and goat industry in the United States. Thank you very much. Until next time, good afternoon.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Change is coming around the bend.